You're listening to coverage from the 2008 Cattle Industry Convention and Trade Show.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay? We're going to go ahead and get started. I am Ryan Rupert with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. I'm the Director of Beef Quality Assurance, and it's my pleasure to introduce a lifelong friend. I've known Dr. Groat Lucian forever. Him and his daughter and I went to school together, and he was our veterinarian until he went to work for the University of Nebraska. So I'd like to thank Pfizer for their 15 years of support of Cattlemen's College, and I'd like to let Dale go ahead and start us off today.
Thanks, Ryan. It's a pleasure to be here. I didn't think I heard Ryan say when he went to school with one of our daughters, but this was like third and fourth grade, Ryan, or when was this? It wasn't exactly college. Okay, back in the good old days, I guess. Well, I'm not going to spend very much time here in front of you because I think the rest of the topics here this morning are where we want to go. But I just like to comment that, you know, this is a session really on designing animal health programs. We certainly have tools and resources and thinking that are present that were not available not very many years ago. And I think we're well recognizing in the industry the importance of lifetime, you know, productivity. Things that happen during gestation or early in life affect animals through their entire production cycle. So we're not only interested in, you know, acute disease, but also chronic disease, as well as impacts on productivity such as carcass quality, average daily gain. So we're trying to grasp what we need to get back in our production systems that we can gain by more up-to-date control of disease. And our speaker's going to be talking about biosecurity and biocontainment concepts. And I think the two topics that are coming up are going to be our excellent examples of biosecurity and biocontainment. You know, simply, what can we do to prevent disease or an agent entry into our operations? And then for agents that are already present, what can we do, what should we do to control them in our herd situation? So I think you're going to enjoy the speakers, the presenters in the next hour and a half, and we'll look forward to it very much. So with that, Ryan, I'm going to step back. Thank you.
Thank you, Dale. We really appreciate your support for Cattlemen's College. We want to start today with Dr. Dave Smith from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. He's a veterinarian there, and I will let him introduce himself.
Thanks, Ryan. Can you hear me all right? Is that carrying all right? Okay. I really appreciate the opportunity to... I see I'm limited by my... There we go. I'm really glad to be here. Appreciate the invitation to be here. I want to talk about one particular aspect of disease control. So the theme of the morning is going to be managing your cattle to control infectious diseases. I'm going to talk about one particular problem as it relates to calf scours, diarrhea, and baby calves. And we're going to hear some other things about some other disease problems. So I'm going to talk about the principles of the Sandhills calving system. The Sandhills calving system is a management approach to controlling calf scours. So there's lots. We've got some research data that I'm going to share with you. Lots of testimonials from ranchers that have used this system. This is a rancher that's used the system, and this was I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but this was a story that was in Successful Farming. Rancher in Nebraska, Terry Clemens, and he is shown here finishing a chore that has helped cut calf scours on his Luke County, Nebraska ranch to non-existent. All right, so when I first met Terry Clements, it was hard, would be hard to imagine that, that you'd have a comment like that. The calf scours was non-existent in this this ranching operation. So I'm going to talk about the things that, that Terry has done that's made a difference in his herd, and more importantly, the principles that go behind it, because I get a lot of calls from ranchers that say, well, this all sounds fine, but is there some other way of applying, of doing the same thing? And so I want you to be creative in thinking about how the principles that we use to come up with this idea might be applicable to your own ranch setting. All right. I started an extension about 10 years ago at the University of Nebraska, and one of the first things they told me to do is, Dave, when you go out and you talk to cattlemen, don't be, you know, showing slides of hogs and talking about hogs, but I want to illustrate that the concepts that I'm going to talk about are not new concepts at all. So this is something from veterinary history years ago, the McLean County system of swine sanitation. Has anybody ever heard of that before? Well, I'm talking to the wrong audience, obviously, but this was a disease problem that affected pigs back in the 1920s, early part of the 20th century. They were limited in their ability to produce healthy, thrifty pigs because of roundworms. All right, so baby pigs would pick up these acrid eggs out in the pastures. They were running with the sows. They'd pick up these eggs. They'd be heavily parasitized, and they wouldn't be very productive. All right, how to solve this problem? And this is in an era before we had good deworming agents and things like that. And so the system that they came up with to control that was to bring the sows in off of that pasture to farrow, wash the udder so that there was no eggs sticking to the udder, the pig wasn't going to get a dose of infection from the sow. And then they would transport that pig and sow out to a pasture that had not been used for pigs in the past, or at least it had been, you know, plowed up, had been a cornfield in between times, right? So that they were putting those pigs onto a clean pasture where they wouldn't be exposed to those acrid eggs. All right, it was very successful, and so at a time that was an important way of controlling disease. So these principles of biosecurity and biocontainment that I'm going to talk about, I want to illustrate with an example that I use with veterinary students to come to Nebraska. So we'll talk a little bit about domino ranching. I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with domino ranching, but you're familiar with dominoes, aren't you? So you know that one of the things you can do with dominoes is stack them up, but one thing that always happens is that they fall down. So we'll think about that in terms of being a domino disease. All right, so the one disease we have to worry about with dominoes is that they fall down. All right, so if you were going to make the situation as bad as possible, this is the interactive part of the program here. So if you're going to make this as bad as possible, how would you set those dominoes up so that the most dominoes would fall down? All right, I heard somebody say it. Put them close together, right? So that if one domino falls down, it hits the next domino, and then the next domino falls down. So the closer we can get them, the worse it's going to be. And if you were going to maximize it, absolutely maximize it, you know, the biggest, what are we trying to do? I'll give you the answer to that one, because it's actually the same thing, but you want to set it up so that if one domino falls down, it hits at least two. And if those dominoes fall down, they hit at least two. So you're maximizing how rapidly those dominoes fall down. Does that make sense? Now stay with me on this, because at the end, if you all get through this, we're going to give you a certificate. You'll all be able to, you'll be eligible to practice on dominoes, okay? So we're starting to understand the disease process with dominoes. Now let's think about what you'd do if you were going to try to control this disease problem with dominoes. All right, so what can we do? We've got this problem with dominoes falling down. We've got our herds of dominoes. We don't want them to fall down. What can we do? Okay, spread them out. Does everybody see how that, and what happens if we spread those dominoes out? Well, if one falls down, it doesn't necessarily hit another domino and knock it down, right? Okay, so that's one very good effective strategy. But that's going to take a lot of land, right? We've got to spread these dominoes out over a lot of acres, sections, whatever. So what else could we do? Oh, that's a good one. So lay them down. Lay them down flat. I don't think you mean kill them all, right? You know. Okay, but if they're because I've had that suggested before. Market them before they fall down. And I. But we could lay them down so that they're not so tall and they're more resistant to falling over, right? Or another strategy like that would be, well, let's glue them to the table so that they're more resistant to falling down. So one is, well, maybe we can breed those dominoes so that they're more like this than like this, and they're less likely to fall down. So we could breed them for that resistance to falling over. We could apply some other intervention like glue or tape that would make them more resistant to falling down. All right, so we've got two good strategies for controlling this disease process. Can you think of another one? Stop them from falling down in the first place? All right, yeah. So how do they fall down, and what happens to make the first domino fall down? Well, somebody knocks it over, right? Somebody pushes the first domino over. What if we took our dominoes and we set them someplace where nobody's going to knock the first domino down? If the first domino falls, none of the rest of the dominoes fall. Does that sound reasonable? Three different strategies for controlling domino disease. And we can use those same three strategies for any infectious disease process that I could think of. All right? So what we're talking about, particularly with calf scours, is biocontainment. Those are the actions that you would take on your ranch that would control the spread of infectious agents, the transmission of this process. Okay, so biosecurity happens within population, or biocontainment occurs within a population, and when we talk about one ranch versus the next one, we call that biosecurity. So what do? Prevent effective contacts. Physically separating animals, minimizing their contact time, decreasing the dose load of exposure. Those are the strategies for preventing effective contacts. That's very much like what we talked about when we said we'll spread those dominoes out. Okay. Second thing they told me when I started in an extension was, well, when you're talking to a beef group, it's best to minimize how many pictures of Holstein cows you show. So I'm already on strike two. But this picture illustrates an important point. She's infected with BVD virus. All right. So this cow's got BVD virus. There's millions and millions of viral particles coming out of her nose. So an effective contact is when other animals come in contact with that mucus secretion, those virus particles. That can happen because of a direct contact with her. So other animals that are commingled with her. But we could take her out of this pen, and you could still have effective contacts when other cattle immediately come in and drink out of this water tank, right? In fact, you could have a lot more effective contacts from cattle drinking out of the tank than coming in contact with her. So there's lots of ways that you can have effective contacts, and some of those things can really amplify the opportunity for transmission. Second principle, increase host resistance. And by the way, we got these in the right order when we were talking about the dominoes. So this is the idea of setting those dominoes on their side so they're less likely to fall down. We do a lot of things with breeding, nutrition, and we use vaccines to increase the resistance of the host against very specific pathogens. All right, and the final one was the idea of, well, don't let that first domino fall down. Well, let's not let the pathogen into the herd in the first place. And if it's there, let's get it out of there. All right, and we'll see that sometimes that's an effective strategy and sometimes it's not. All of these can be effective strategies or not, depending on the disease process that we're dealing with. All right, so the topic for today, then, or my topic for the day, is neonatal calf diarrhea. You're probably familiar with calf scours because you've seen it on your neighbor's ranch. All right, so you want to go back home and tell them what you saw here. Neonatal calf scours is important because of losses, because of calves dying. Those calves that survive may be less productive. You've got treatment costs associated with trying to save those calves. And there's actually a huge human toll that we don't talk about very often. First thing is, when you're out there catching calves to treat them, give them fluids and so forth, you're at risk for getting hurt. And everybody has stories about some mama cow putting them in the cab of the pickup truck or something like that. And when you're spending all your time out there catching calves, you're just putting yourself at increased risk for getting injured, let alone the calf giving you a quick kick to the jaw or something. there's a lot of frustration. When I go to ranches that are experiencing calf scours, the calves are dying. They've worked day and night to get those live calves on the ground, and then within a few weeks, they're seeing those calves wither and die. There's a lot of frustration that goes along with that, and it's hard to measure, but it's certainly present. There are some public health concerns about calf scours. So some of the pathogens that make calves sick, give them diarrhea, also make people sick. All right, so pathogens like Cryptosporidia, Salmonella. And there is, you know, the concern about using antibiotics in any type of an application, whether it's for humans or animals. The more we can minimize that, the more we save those antibiotics for when we really need them, and we minimize the development of antimicrobial resistance. For many ranchers, the most likely reason that they're going to pick up a bottle of an antibiotic is because they've got scouring calves that they want to treat. All right. So the agents that cause calf scours are numerous. There's bacteria, there's viruses, there's protozoa. We sometimes see these fungal infections. So after a calf has been treated with antibiotics for an extended period of time and you've wiped out all of the normal flora, then these fungal infections take over. And so a lot of calves that we post actually end up dying from a fungal infection. It wasn't what started the problem, but it's what finished it. These agents that cause calf scours are present in every cattle herd. So if we look hard enough, we can find at least most of the agents, rotavirus, coronavirus, crypto. They're present everywhere, even in the herds that are not having problems with scours. All right, and so what that leaves us with then is this balance between the immune status of the calf, the ability of that calf to resist these infections, and its level of exposure to those pathogens. And that battle starts to take place at birth. So the first thing that calf may swallow is a dose load of pathogens that are going to kill it, or it may be getting the colostrum that provides the antibodies and other immune system parameters that will help that calf fight those infections. The protection that calf gets from colostrum at birth is going to disappear with time. Now, gradually with time, that calf is going to develop its own active immune response. So as it's exposed to those pathogens, its immune system ramps up and builds some protection. But there may be a period of time when antibodies from colostrum, that passive protection, is being lost, and we haven't quite got that active immune response ramped up to go yet, and so there might be a period of time when that calf is more susceptible to scours. And if there is a sufficient level of exposure, high enough to overwhelm that immune system, we may see scours. All right, and that is what we see. We see calves dying from scours within a very narrow range of age. All right, and that's typically between 1 week of age and 2 weeks of age. Most calves in their second and third weeks of life, are if they're going to die from scours, that's when it's going to happen. So that's the population of calves that are susceptible to scours. It's also the age when calves become infective. So store that away. What I'm talking about is the age that calves are able to transmit that pathogen to another calf. Okay, so in they're not just infected, they're not just susceptible to infection, but if they do become infected, that's the age when they can start to pass that on. That's like the domino hitting the next domino. Okay? All right. In Nebraska, we've spent a number of years, Dr. Grotolution's been involved with this work, many other pathologists in the diagnostic lab, veterinarians out in the field helped us work on this problem of calf scours. We conducted diagnostic investigations from cases coming in. We did some outbreak investigations going to ranches that were having severe losses. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some case studies about how we tried to intervene. This work was done in the Nebraska Sandhills, a very unique area of the country. I don't know if all of you have been to the Nebraska Sandhills. If you haven't been, it's sure worth the trip. Anyways, the work is done there. I'm going to describe a few ranches some of the things we learned from some of those ranches in the Sandhills, but these principles are more widely applicable than just within the Sandhills in Nebraska. All right, so one of those herds was an interesting case. I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about this one herd because it represents what we saw on a lot of the ranches that we were investigating. This is a herd with 402 cattle that had live births in this particular calving season. They're managed in an intensive grazing, grass management system. So every few days they're moving these cattle to a new pasture. They've had a history of scours in this ranch for a number of years, higher than acceptable death losses. This year they decided to put their management efforts to other than trying to catch and treat calves. Okay, so no interventions for trying to treat and save sick calves. They lost 48 calves due to scours. Now those were same kind of losses that they were having otherwise, so the treatment interventions weren't being all that effective anyway. But it gave us a very unique opportunity to study this herd because there wasn't anything that interfered with the natural disease process of the outbreak. So this is just like the buffalo moving across the plains, right? Where these cattle are moving as one single group, having this disease outbreak take place, and we could look at the information that we could glean from that. The best thing about this is that this was a ranch. This rancher kept meticulous records, and so we were able to ask some questions about who died and why they died. All right, so we were able to capture those ranch records and analyze them. This is some of that data. So these blue bars represent the number of calves born every week of the calving season. And you can see, looking at the dates, this is a May, calving through May and June. So if you think that it's only, you know, harsh winter weather that's related to scours, I can't think of a more ideal time to have calves than May and June on grass in the sandhills. It would be, you know, just ideal weather conditions. And still, if you look at the black bars along there, you can see when those 48 calves died. So we start off in about the fourth week of the calving season, step up a little bit, and then every week of the calving season, this ranch is losing about 8 calves every week, 48 calves altogether. All right, so when we ask, well, what about those calves? Why, what were characteristics of those calves that caused them to die, helped explain why they died? Well, one of the things was the age of their mothers. All right, so the risk for a calf to die if its mom was a 2-year-old heifer was much higher than if its mom was a 3-year-old cow, which was still much higher than if that was a mature cow taking care of that calf. So why would that be? Does that seem unusual to any of you? Anybody have any reason why you'd think that calves from 2-year-old heifers might be more likely to die from scours? Okay, colostrum. And there's really two characteristics of it, I think. So we might argue that maybe those calves had a little less immunity. Okay? Lower antibody quality and maybe lower volume of antibodies from 2-year-old heifers. So those heifers haven't been exposed to everything yet. They haven't really developed those antibodies to put into the colostrum in the first place. They may have less volume. And another thing is, they're probably just not quite as good mothers yet, right? They haven't learned how to be good moms yet. All right, and so all those things may influence how much, what the quantity of antibodies that calf might have absorbed. All right, so eventually they get better at that, and we see less losses. And this is something that's been seen by a lot of different researchers when they look at calf scours. So we're just happy that it showed up in our study as well. Now, I told you this was an intensive grazing herd. So every couple of days, they're opening the gate, and they're moving cattle into a fresh green grass. All right, so it's a tight bunch group. They're moving through the gates. You train the animals for a certain kind of behavior, which is that when you open the gate up, they go through it, right? Because the cows know when that gate's opened up, there's better grass on the other side. That means that sometimes they leave their calf behind, go get the grass, and then they'll come back and get their calf later on. We wondered, well, gosh, what if that calf was born that day? And they opened up the gate and the cattle went through. Maybe that calf didn't get that same mothering up that it would have gotten on a day, you know, when the cows stayed in the same pasture. Does that make sense to you? Well, in fact, calves that were born on the day of a pasture move were almost twice as likely to die from scours as the calves that were born on those other days. So it sort of makes sense that that might be the case. Age of the calves at death, well, I showed you data like this earlier. So most of the calves died between 7 days of age and about 15 days of age. And very few died after 3 weeks of age. All right, and that didn't matter over the course of the calving season. So from the beginning of the calving season to the end, it tended to be calves between 1 week of age and 2 weeks of age that were dying from scours. All right, so as they moved through their window of susceptibility, they were more likely, that's when they died. Now, but here's the interesting thing. If we look at when that calf was born and its probability to die later on in the calving season, you know, die from scours, calves that were born in the first few weeks had a very low probability of dying from scours. But if you were that unfortunate calf that was born towards the end of the calving season, your risk for dying from scours was much higher. So progressively greater and greater risk of dying from scours as the calving season progressed. Now, why would that be? Yeah, so excellent. I like the way you think, because that's the way I was thinking about the problem. Yeah, so those first few calves, they were born into a better environment than the last few calves. So let's think about how that environment changed over the course of the calving system. All right, first of all, we got more and more calves, so this susceptible population is growing all the time. And we've got this multiplier effect. So the source of these pathogens that we're talking about from 1 year to the next is the cow herd. All right. Now, they don't shed very many, but they're the reason. I can tell you, in Nebraska, we have hot summers and we have cold winters, and these pathogens that we're talking about just don't survive out there from 1 year to the next. We often think about, you know, this pasture being contaminated, but it's the cow herd. The cow herd is where those pathogens survive from 1 year to the next. The cows then start to disseminate those pathogens, small amounts, but the first calves born get a little dose of that infection. Calves are excellent at growing up big numbers of these pathogens. So they're the big multipliers of the pathogens. And so those first calves that are exposed, they grow up a big load, chicks disseminate that in their feces. Calves that are born later can get a bigger dose than that. They can grow that up into an even bigger dose, and it becomes overwhelming. So I'll try to illustrate that. You got the cow herd that's the source of the pathogens in this new calving season. And they expose the first calves that are born, who are going to, you know, shed higher doses of that. They're going to expose calves that are born later on, who make bigger and bigger doses of it until we have this overwhelming load of exposure. All right, and so that's why over the course of the calving season, this exposure opportunity for exposure gets worse and worse. All right, so just like with the dominoes, we've just told you at least everything that I know about this problem, this disease problem with calf scours. So we start out with the dominoes and we said the same thing. What do we need to know about dominoes falling down? Then we can think about what we can do to prevent it. So given the information that I've told you, how can we start to think about controlling this problem? Well, I gave you three different ways that we can control infections, and they're the only three that I know of. Eliminate the agent, keep it out, increase post-resistant, or prevent effective contacts. And I'm going to cross one of them off the list right now, because I already told you these pathogens that cause calf scours, they're endemic, they exist on all cattle herds, and we don't think it's likely that we can go in and eliminate most of these pathogens from the herd. All right, they exist in the cow herd. We're just not going to get rid of them. So let's cross the first one off, and that leaves us with two other ones: increase host resistance and prevent effective contacts. Now, on dairies, they apply these principles by using calf hutches. All right, so you get that calf away from the source of the pathogens, which is the cow herd, as quickly as possible. Put that calf in a hutch. Well, make sure it gets colostrum so that We've got that host resistance. And then we put it in a hutch where it's not going to be exposed to those other infective calves. All right. I went around talking to ranches for years about installing in calf hutch systems and was almost lynched. So I had to stop that. We had to come up with some better system, all right, that would work in a ranch production setting. All right, and just like we already heard, the conditions at the start of the calving system look more favorable than those at the end of the calving system. So let's try to replicate those first few weeks of the calving system over and over again. Let's have 8 1-week calving seasons rather than 1 8-week calving season. All right. So we like that there's a clean calving area. At the beginning of the calving season, those cows went into a pasture where there had not been cows calves, until the year before. And we didn't have those older calves that are such a good source of exposure. Remember those older infective calves? All right. So that was how we developed the Sandhills calving system. The idea is that we put cows into a pasture to calve. Those that drop their calves in that pasture just stay there. We're not mixing or sorting or doing anything with them. They stay right there. At the end of the week, we take those cows that haven't had their calves and we move them on to a new calving pasture. Leave those pairs where they started. At the end of the next week, cows have been calving in that second pasture. We leave those pairs there and we move those heavy cows into the next pasture and so on. So that every week, what we're doing is creating a pasture where all the calves are within a week of age of each other. And we don't have those older infective calves in the same pasture with those young and upcoming susceptible calves. All right, and the system has worked. In the ranches where we've collected years of data, and I need to update my slides now because we followed these ranches up until current time, these are ranches with very meaningful death losses. So this 900 cow herd was losing 50 to 120 calves every year from scours. Implemented the system in 2000, and they've not lost a calf from scours since. They've only treated a few calves for scours in the last 8 years, and most of those have been, all of those were in the first year, and they just got nervous when they saw a few wet tails, and they treated a few of them. Okay, so it's been very successful. Minimal to no antibiotic use. So we measured how much money was spent on various medications for treating scours, and we saw this huge reduction in the medication costs because we don't have calves that need to be treated. Going back to Terry Clements and the article on successful farming, he says this is the number one thing I've done over the years that has benefited us economically. All right. So this system has worked, and I want to point out that we've benefited animal health and well-being. Calves aren't dying; they're not getting sick. We've increased the financial advantage to the rancher. And we've done that using less drugs and those concerns for public health. And we have less of a public health concern because of those pathogens being distributed out into the environment. So a lot of good things going on here. And again, I want to point out that none of these concepts are new. These were concepts that were being espoused back in the 1930s. In Lincoln, Nebraska, the head of my department was Leonis Van Ess. He wrote this landmark text about animal hygiene, principle of animal hygiene, preventive veterinary medicine. He talked about these same types of issues. He said those more particularly concerned with the food-producing animals must think in terms of hygiene, for their success is in no small measure dependent upon their knowledge of the subject. All right, so with that, I think we're going to take questions later, Ryan. I'd be glad to talk with any of you. Please call me in my office or visit our website to get more information. There's some materials in the handouts here, but I appreciate your time and attention. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to introduce Dan Gibbons from Auburn University, who, as well as Dave, is a veterinarian. And we'll let him continue on.
Can you hear me okay in the back? The privilege to be here with you. And I'm going to continue on this topic of biosecurity and biocontainment. As we do that, it's really helpful for me to make sure I understand terms. I'm also going to focus on a little different disease. I'm going to focus on bovine viral diarrhea virus. But just to make sure that we understand it, if we take the back row of individuals at the table over here, odds are that if each of those are producers, if you run the statistics, one of those individuals probably has some persistently infected animals on their farm. And as we define terms, biocontainment means that if it's the lady at the back table whose farm has the persistently infected animal, biocontainment means she keeps it from spreading throughout her farm. So she's concerned about biocontainment. But everybody else at that back table is not so much concerned about biocontainment with DVD if they don't have it to start with. They're concerned about biosecurity. They're concerned about bringing the pathogen onto the farm. As we talk about this, the whole goal of our session this morning is to develop plans to minimize disease. I think it's important as we talk about this, the goal of biosecurity is to minimize the total cost of disease. Well, that's a nice, ambiguous statement to make, but what do we really mean there? Well, I want to challenge you to apply this to your own situation. What we mean there is we want to minimize the production losses due to disease. But that's not the total cost of disease. The total cost of disease occurs when we add in the production losses plus the production losses due to biosecurity. What do I mean there? What I mean there is if your biosecurity means that you move the animals more, if you do things that actually decreases their productivity, you're dealing with a situation where your biosecurity procedures may actually affect production. And then we have the cost of the biosecurity expenditures. Okay, the glue to glue the dominoes to the table cost us some money. Okay, the vaccines to vaccinate the calves cost us some money. The total cost of disease is when you add these three things together, what's your total cost of disease? All of us have a cost of disease, whether we have the disease on the farm or not. Your goal for economic purposes has to be to optimize the equation. Okay? If, for instance, I tell you that you can minimize DVD on your farm by minimizing contact with all other wildlife, therefore you could go home and build a 12-foot-high deer-proof fence all the way around your operation. Well, that might keep DVD off your farm. You might drive the production losses to zero, but your biosecurity expenditures are going to be so high, there's no value in you doing that. So the goal in the process has to be to optimize the equation. You want your financial inputs for biosecurity to decrease disease to a level that your total cost in the equation are going to be minimized. So as we think through bovine viral diarrhea virus, we want to consider this. What are the practical biosecurity measures that will minimize disease, but not cost so much that will optimize the equation? To me, that's the beautiful thing about the Sandhills calving system. Is the Sandhill calving system doesn't cost a lot of money to implement on most farms. And therefore, your cost of biosecurity expenditures and your production losses are minimal, but it really drives down this loss of disease. So as we look at bovine viral diarrhea virus, and as we look at what procedures we want to put in place to minimize that, to optimize this equation, we have to understand, first of all, what are the production losses due to disease? I love when Dave shows those slides with all the calves lined up dead. Because it motivates all of us to realize there's a great risk in that disease, and therefore we need to minimize that risk, and we go home and we make changes because of that. We need to understand that our perception of risk affects what we do. Okay? Right now, unfortunately, in the southeastern United States today, if you're selling tornado insurance, you've got a really easy market to sell in. It's not that the chances of a tornado are any higher tomorrow than they were 2 weeks ago. But because everybody in the southeast, because of what happened last night, understands there's a real risk. And since they understand the risk, they put security measures in place so that they hopefully don't experience those losses. In some ways, we need to realize that that's the case. But we also need to realize the risk from things that aren't as dramatic. I'm talking about things like, and my analogy would be termites. Okay? Termites don't make the news. Okay? But termites are a tremendous impactor on the financial well-being of individuals. Either your house falls in because they chew out the foundation, or you can't sell your house for as much money because of the termites. So we need to realize, just because a production loss may not be making the news this week, we need to appropriately assess the risk. So those are some broad comments on biosecurity and biocontainment. But let's specifically look at bovine viral diarrhea virus. We have to understand some of the ecology, some of the way this virus spreads, so that we can implement changes. Many of you are very familiar with this. But let me review it for you just to make sure that we're all on the same page. As we look at bovine viral diarrhea virus, we can have acute infections. Okay? These acute infections, if the animal is pregnant, can result in fetal infections. Fetal infections at the wrong time can result in persistent infections. I want to make sure we contrast BVD with some of the causes of calf scours. Fortunately, BVD is something we can truly prevent from being on your farm. Most farms, unless you're in the middle of a situation where all of your neighbors are trading cattle so fast and you can't prevent some fence line contact, most farms we can keep BVD off the farm. And that's different from what we deal with in calf scours. We can really affect the ecology of the virus. The key part of this understanding is acute infections, which can also be called transient infections. Those are kind of like the common cold. You get it, you get over it, it's no big deal. Transient infections with BVD. Now yes, transient infections can cause some disease loss. This is where vaccine can play a critical role. Vaccines are important because they can prevent some of this transient loss. And transient loss can look differently depending on which strain of virus you're dealing with and depending on the environment. Okay, if you're in the middle of a snowstorm and you add BVD as a stressor on those cattle in the snowstorm, you're going to have a lot more disease than if you don't have the snowstorm. Or if you have the snowstorm and don't have the virus. Some acute infections won't cause many signs at all. Some will cause acute death, diarrhea, bleeding disorders, respiratory disease, and other problems. But a key factor that we're worried about is when these animals are pregnant and develop a fetal infection. Fetal infection can result in abortion, can result in birth defects. We can have transient in utero infections where the calf is infected in utero and then gets over it, is born with antibodies, or we can have these persistent infections. Persistent infections occur when the calves are infected within the first 5 months of gestation. When it's inside the uterus, the virus infects the cow, goes through the cow, gets to the calf. We get these PI calves. These PI calves can show acute death, poor performance. When I say acute death, there's nothing more frustrating than having those newborn calves hit the ground. Look good, you're doing the Sandhills calving system, but you never have tested or instituted any other biosecurity measures for BVD, and they start dying on you. Dave, what's wrong? I'm doing the Sandhills calving system, but the calves are still dying. Well, BVD could be a player in the game. And we can test it, and we can institute control measures to eliminate it. These persistently infected animals can appear normal at times. So you can't just tell them by looking at them. Mucosal disease, severe diarrhea, normally a rapid death in those situations, some of these persistently infected calves can spread mucosal disease from one calf to another. And you can have a bunch of them die all at one time. If we look at gestation, we can have abortions anywhere throughout gestation. You can have a late abortion, early abortion, DVD can cause that. The other thing we've already mentioned is this persistent infection. If we get an infection with a non-cytopathic strain of DVD and all non-cytopathic infections, if it doesn't kill cells in the laboratory, if a calf gets infected with non-cytopathic DVD within the first 5 months of gestation, we can get a PI calf. This is a 2-year-old bull right here. You can look at this 2-year-old bull and tell, here's compared to a cohort, this 2-year-old bull looks terrible. Okay? Not making any comments about Hereford genetics. Please forgive me if you're a Hereford breeder. Okay? What I'm trying to communicate is he's not had an acceptable growth rate. This is a terrible animal. Persistent infection can cause poor growth rates, these terrible animals. They just don't perform well, they don't grow well. But the thing I want you to remember from this slide is not that that animal is persistently infected. I want to make sure you remember the perfectly normal-looking limousine bull standing beside him is also persistently infected. This bull grew well. He's doing fine. He's growing okay. He looks fine. There's no problem with him. There's no problem with him, but he is persistently infected. And what that means is every excretion that he puts out, fecal material, urine, hair follicles, snot, spit, has enough virus in it that I could take it and put less than a tenth of a cc in an Olympic-sized swimming pool, stir it up, go to the other side, let some cattle drink out of it, and 50% of them are going to get infected. The same virus that doesn't cause any significant clinical signs in this animal can cause severe abortion problems. So persistently infected animals can look like this and be pathetic. They can also look like this and be phenotypically normal. But that virus will cause disease when this transmitter of virus infects other animals. We can also get congenital defects. These calves that are infected right around 150 days of age, of gestation, infection at this point will cause calves that have abnormal brain defects. They can't regulate fine motor skills. They stand like this. They wobble when they try to nurse. Okay, it's a real problem. Most of these calves in less intensive management situations are just found dead because they never can get up and nurse and go. Under intensive management situations, you may be able to get them to survive for a period of time. Unfortunately, you're helping them to spread some virus. But most of these animals will not be persistently infected. Most of these calves that have congenital defects will just be unthrifty. They will be unviable, but they're not persistently infected. The persistently infected calves are the calves that get infected before that time period that don't have congenital defects and can move around okay. And then we need to realize that the immune system in this calf can respond to DVD once it passes 5 months of gestation. So if you have a calf that gets infected in utero 2 months before it's born, it's going to be born with antibodies. Its immune system mounted an immune response, and it's going to be okay. It's not spreading virus. It doesn't have a brain defect. It may have some adverse health events. I'm not saying we want to infect calves at that stage and age of gestation, but we don't see the negative consequences that we would see at other times. So if we talk about Alabama, breeding season oftentimes in the state of Alabama turn the bulls in January 1st. If we look at that, our calving season then is going to be the latter part of the year, sometimes starting in October. We'll do our breeding soundness exams on the bulls at this point before we turn them in. I'm just trying to mark out a management calendar for you here so I can show you an example of what you can do to prevent DVD spreading on the farm. In March, a lot of those farms will castrate, dehorn, vaccinate calves. May, wean calves, preg check cows. We might deworm in August, hot month in Alabama. It's an easy time to do a strategic deworming for the worm's sake, but not for the animal's sake. But what I want to show you is this. In this management system, we need to realize we need to intensively do biosecurity from January until August because that's when the calves are susceptible. That's why you guys in the back row don't need to buy calves or bulls or any animals and I apologize for using you as the example of the person who has DVD on the farm, because you really don't, and I want to make sure everybody knows that. But if she has DVD on her farm, don't buy animals from her when you've got pregnancies in the first 9 months of gestation. Okay? Absolutely don't bring them on the farm. Because you can make a lot of PI calves on your farm, you can have real problems. The next speaker is going to give you some first-hand experience of those real problems that you can experience when you have DVD on the farm. So we want to practice good biosecurity, especially when these animals are becoming pregnant during the first 5 months of gestation. Because we've already talked about it, it's the first 5 months of gestation when new persistently infected calves are made. The other thing that we want to do is we want to institute testing of calves and introduce herd additions that have been tested prior to the breeding season. And this is not true just for BVD. This is true for lots of infectious diseases. Let's test those animals. Let's bring the animals onto the farm when animals aren't quite as stressed. Let's bring them in when it's the safest time for the animals on the farm. So this is the period of time that we're trying to protect. We want to plan our management calendar around that. Some good biosecurity measures will have effects on diseases other than BVD, but BVD can certainly give us a step up on controlling many things on the farm. And I'm focused on the cow-calf sector. Okay, I'm in the Southeast. I think we have to focus on the cow-calf sector. And yes, all you guys in the feed yards can look at the cow-calf sector and say, I don't make any persistently infected animals on my place. You can. You can say that because all of the persistently infected animals are made in utero. So if you don't have any gestating cows on your farm, you can say, I'm not making any PI animals. I think we do have a responsibility as a cow-calf sector to protect the other segments of the industry from BVD. And at the same time, it helps the cow-calf sector if they are rewarded financially for having good biosecurity. You all know that drill much better than I do. So what is biosecurity? I have to keep things simple to actually institute them on the farm. I have to say, what am I trying to protect against? And in this talk, we've defined it as BVD is their focus for biosecurity. The other thing I say is, why not just vaccinate? The third thing is how to do biosecurity. So let's review these three simple topics. Let's talk about what am I trying to protect against, why not just vaccinate, and how to do biosecurity. We've already talked about BVD as far as what I'm trying to protect against. You can also put other diseases on your list as you think about your farm. Is it Yoni's disease that you're concerned about? Some of you may be yes, some of you may be no. What about infectious bovine rhinotracheitis? Is that your disease of concern? Is it trick? Are you concerned about Trichomonas fetus? What's your disease of concern? And then develop your protocols for biosafety regarding the disease of interest, whether it's trick or BVD or Yoni's or whatever. Two, why not just vaccinate? This is just a quick slide for you, okay, showing you all the different vaccines out there. I show you this slide to say, and this is a slide that's focused on BVD, there's lots of vaccine choices. I want to be honest with you. No vaccine for BVD will provide 100% protection. And I say that being very straightforward and honest. Okay, and I appreciate the fact that Pfizer has sponsored this. Pfizer has a tremendous product. If Dale Grevolution were in the room, Dale would agree. He would state to you, our vaccine is not going to provide 100% protection against BVD. You can't just vaccinate and go home. We would like to, but you can't do that. If you talk to the R&D folks involved with the vaccine companies, they will tell you that very clearly. They can provide significant protection. They can provide important protection. Those vaccines should be used, but they're not going to provide 100% protection. And when we're dealing with BVD, if we get a persistently infected calf in the group, and that calf is shedding virus to all the other calves, especially if they are then sent to the feed yards and commingled with other animals, we can have real train wrecks, even if we're vaccinated. So we have to look at vaccines won't provide complete protection, and we have to be honest about that. And you can look at killed vaccines, modified live vaccines, vaccines that contain both type 1 and type 2, and all, those are good things. Use a vaccine that contains both a type 1 and a type 2 strain of BVD. Okay? But understand that you can't get 100% protection with vaccination. And those are just the things we live with. Biosecurity. Biosecurity is simply controlling the movement of people, objects, and animals. That's all it is. Because this is how disease-causing agents, this is how pathogens are spread. They're spread either by people, objects, or animals. And yes, you can have some air spread of things, but that's not what we're talking about. BVD does not go a mile in the air. Okay, I can actually maintain animals 35 feet from persistently infected animals, and as long as their farm manager and the folks on the farm don't walk from the PI pen into the non-vaccinated pen, those animals will stay free of antibodies to BVD. I'm not recommending that you do that on your place, but on a research farm, BVD is not spread for miles in the air. It's spread by contact. It's spread by the water trough that Dave showed you, where the cow who's got snot coming out of her nose drinking out of the water trough is shared by another individual. People, objects, and animals are what we need to control the movement of. For BVD, the first step, in my opinion, is to identify and remove persistently infected animals from your herd. Okay, and you've got lots of choices for diagnostic tests. Depending on what the return or reward is going to be for your farm, will help you choose which test to use. But test, do you have BVD on your farm or not? Because that tells you, do I need to practice biocontainment or do I need to practice biosecurity? Where am I in that game? So first, test to remove persistently infected animals from your herd. And we do have folks that are working on BVD. There is the NCBA BVD working group that's going to provide you literature. If you're interested more in test selection, I would strongly encourage you to visit the BVD control booth that you will find in the exhibitor center. They're not trying to sell you anything. They're simply trying to provide educational information to you to help you with BVD control. So if you have more questions about which test should I use on BVD, stop by that booth, talk to the folks there. You can't identify them just by looking at them. It'd be nice if you could. You know, if you could go through your farm and say, every animal that has that poor performance, I'm going to test that one for BVD and I don't have to test the other ones. But it doesn't work that way. Sometimes it's the animals that look phenotypically normal who are shedding the virus that's causing other cows to abort or decrease fertility or cause other problems on your farm. You can't visually diagnose all the PI animals. Number two, and you have this sheet in your list, in your handout, on that back page. Don't introduce cattle into your herd that lack previous testing for BVD, especially during the first 5 months of the breeding season. You all understand that. You don't want to bring virus onto the farm because that persistently infected animal is doing a great job of spreading virus. Test the animals before they come on the farm. Quarantine animals for a period of 21 days while you're getting all that testing done, so that they're not going to have an acute infection and spread it to other animals on the farm. We've already talked about the disease control process down there. Number three, prevent your cattle from contacting cattle outside your herd, especially during the breeding season of the first 5 months of gestation. Now look, I started this presentation with the slide. I'm not trying to stop you from doing what you need to do. Some of you all, because of the existence of the operation that you're working with, you need to exhibit animals. You need to show animals. Some of you all may be in a situation where you feel obligated to expose animals that are within that first 5 months of gestation to animals outside the farm. And I understand that. If you have to do that, if contact occurs with your non-pregnant animals, simply quarantine them when you come back onto the farm. It's a great biosecurity procedure. That's going to keep BVD from spreading on your farm. What if you've got to take a pregnant cow and take her to the show? Just feel like you have to do that. If that's where you are and if that's what you have to do, unfortunately, the recommendation has to be that calf could become persistently infected. That's Okay? If she's well vaccinated, that really limits that risk, but there's the chance that she could become persistently infected. If we want to really prevent BVD from coming onto the farm, we need to isolate that animal until the calf is born and tested. I'm sorry, it's one of the frustrations. There is no good test for a calf inside a cow to say if the calf is persistently infected or not. I just can't do it. Sure, I could do a cystocentesis. That'll cause a lot of them to abort. Well, then, if she aborts, why do we care if it's persistently infected? Okay? Unfortunately, that's where they are. Unless 4 feet are on the ground, there's not a good test for PI animals. Don't allow people wearing boots and coveralls contaminated by other herds to contact your cattle. I show you a picture here of a group of individuals out on the research farm, and I know the game. Sometimes everybody wants to look like it's not their first rodeo. You know, they want to get the old hat that's all messed up and want to wear some old clothes. It's a great way to spread virus, especially if you just came from a neighbor's herd. Okay? Especially if you're running from one farm to another. Boots and coveralls. BVD is easy to kill. I can kill it with dishwashing detergent. That's why I like BVD. I don't like talking about some of those agents you talked about, because some of those things are tough to kill on the farm, and you have to say, they're going to be on the farm, we're going to live with them. You can kill BVD with dishwashing detergent. It's an easy virus to kill, and I'm not making that up. It really is, and it's an envelope virus. If you simply wash your hands, scrub your boots with some detergent, you're going to kill the virus. This is not a thing of I'm saying you need to sterilize every piece of clothing on you. I'm just telling you, practice some sanitation. The name of the book, the red book, was hygiene, right? Practice appropriate hygiene. If you can kill the virus with dishwashing detergent, maybe we can make some progress in BVD control. Don't allow dirty or contaminated instruments in your herd to contact your cattle. Dirty or contaminated instruments, nose tongs, vaccine vials, balling guns, dehorners, castrating knives, tagging pliers. Scrub them off. Don't transmit the virus with those objects. The reason I show this picture, I come from Central Kentucky. My father runs a farm supply center there in Central Kentucky, has for the past 25 years. Had some small producers that wanted him to provide a little portable chute system they could rent. You know, because they only need it 1 week a year. Let me rent the portable chute system, take it from your farm to mine. That's a great way to spread virus. What do you rent? What do you borrow? What do you not simply scrub off with a little bit of dishwashing detergent before you allow it to contact your cattle? What do I rent? Those are concerns about biosecurity. And then we can go down the list. Okay, fly control. Maybe some blood-sucking flies can play a role here. Don't think they're extremely significant. What about contact with wildlife? Yes, wildlife can harbor BVD. Can wildlife spread it to our farms? They can. But that potential is very low. Make sure you don't misinterpret. Don't say, well, since I can't limit contact with wildlife, I'm not going to test for persistently infected animals. I think you are disproportionately associating risk. There's more risk with animals. There's more risk with people and objects than there is with wildlife. So don't disproportionately allocate that risk and allow that not to make decisions for you. So with that, that's just a focus on bovine viral diarrhea virus. That's a focus looking at how you can implement some biosecurity procedures. The greatest risk is movement and mixing of cattle. Stress, naive groups, purchase of new additions. I've seen some really neat outbreaks with BVD. Let me give you some recipes for disaster. Buy a bunch of new heifers and then commingle those new heifers with your cows as you do an estrus synchronization protocol. That'll get you some real infertility and some real persistently infected calves. Because you commingle them. You got them all. You got your dominoes close together. When you do that estrus synchronization protocol, you know, you you want to check heat, so you want the cows up there close to the house. So let's put the dominoes real close together so we can check heats. Well, that's great, especially if we've just bought some new heifers to put in the group. Think about how you handle the animals. Segregate populations, especially those new animals you're purchasing. maintain a stable herd. Semen and embryos are a great way to introduce new genetics without introducing virus. If your straw of semen has the letter CSS on it, which stands for Certified Semen Services, it's safe. You've got biosecurity built into that straw of semen. If your embryos have been washed 10 times, according to International Embryo Transfer Society protocols, they have a great degree of safety. If you need new genetics, that's a way to do it and still maintain your biosecurity. If you bring in pregnant animals, you've got to quarantine them until they calve so you can test those calves when they hit the ground. Biosecurity is simply controlling the movement of people, objects, and animals. And that's your goal, to prevent the spread of disease onto the farm. With that, I'm going to end realizing that I'll go back to this initial equation, because our goal is to minimize the total cost of disease. And as we minimize the total cost of disease, we're looking to have biosecurity expenditures and production losses due to the biosecurity that are very low, which still effectively minimize production losses. We want to optimize the balance on that equation. Thank you for your time and attention. I'll turn this back over and we'll take questions at the end.
I'd like to introduce Tom Hogan. He's a rancher from Montana. He's going to talk about his operation.
I'm Tom Hogan, a rancher from Montana who has experienced BVD. And what I want to do today, Dan has set it up, he's explained it, he's given you all the facts. I'm going to give you the facts of what happens to a rancher that isn't prepared, which I wasn't, and then how I dealt with it over the next few years to eliminate BVD out of my herd. There are basics to biosecurity, and I was pretty dumb 5 years ago. Wasn't aware of any of this, and I think there are probably lots of ranchers out there that were just like me. I thought I was progressive. I thought I was doing everything right, but I didn't know these things. I didn't know enough to increase the disease through vaccination. The handling of my livestock, I moved all of my cows from Montana to North Dakota during the drought. Multiple places I had those cows. I did do animal identification so that when it got to the point that I had to do something, I was prepared with animals that were identified. I'm going to give you a timeline of what happened on my ranch. In the fall of 2002, we historically sold our steer calves off to an order buyer and they went to Oklahoma. But we kept our heifer calves. And we bred a lot of those heifer calves, but we kept them there. Well, in the fall of 2002, all of a sudden we had heifer calves, sick calves, sick calves, sick calves, multiple trees. Also, later in that year, in our bred heifers, we had unexplained abortions, higher than normal. We had no idea why. Then in January, I attended a meeting similar to this on PIBVD. And during that meeting, they showed a picture of a PI calf. I still didn't know I had a problem. I just happened to be lucky enough to attend that meeting. Well, then in the spring of 2003, we had higher than normal death loss on our calves of our two-year-old heifers. And they were happening after we got them out of the corral and turned to the pasture. Again, no reason. I mean, I don't know why. At least I didn't at that point. And I guess I can't even today say for sure that BVD was the problem. But when I look back, I have to think so. We also had a higher than normal death loss in our cow herd during the summer. In the fall of 2003, again, sold our steer calves, went to a fellow in Oklahoma. we had sick calves in our heifers. And we started finding heifers that we couldn't treat. I tried every drug there was on the market. And part of it we blamed on the drought. We'd been through multiple years of drought. But then one day, after treating the four or five heifer calves multiple times, it was like somebody hit me in the head. One of those calves looked like that one I'd seen at the producer meeting. So I called my veterinarian, and I came down. I said, I want you to look at these calves. So he came and looked, and he said, you think they're PIVVD, don't you? I said, yeah, that's what I think. So we tested them. Obviously, they came back positive. So we knew we had the trouble. I don't know how many I lost, because it was a lot of them had already been disposed of. I got on the phone and called the fellow in Oklahoma that had bought my steer calves. I said, are you having trouble with sick calves? He said, yeah. He says, we can't, multiple treats, we can't get them over. I said, test them for PIVVD. Same thing. He had the same results. I'm assuming between the two of us, we lost at least 20 calves that fall, the weaned calves. So we knew we had PIVVD, and we had not been vaccinating our cow herd. That was, I didn't think we had a problem. So we set up an action plan with my veterinarian, and we did not historically vaccinate our cows in the spring, so it was a challenge. They're out in big pastures. How are we going to vaccinate those cows when we're not at a corral? We had multiple pastures, and we branded. But we managed to do it. It was not an impossible task. We, at the same time, at branding, we ear-notched those calves out of that crop of cows. When we got all the results back, we had a pretty sick family. We had 39 PI calves out of 1,320. So we went back to those pastures and started pairing those cows and calves off to get them isolated away from our main cow herd. During that time, one of those calves had already died within probably less than 2 weeks of testing. That was the first one that had died. When we were gathering them up, we had one dead one. It might be on the next screen. During the summer, we had those cows isolated in a pasture by themselves, and we also tested all of those 39 cows to see if we had any positive cows. We did not. We had also tested our bulls before they went out in the spring, and we had no positives in the bulls. So we wondered, how did we get PIVVD? We don't know. It had to be fence line, and I think it was probably over a period of years. It just kept getting bigger. Well, being a little bit stubborn and maybe wanting to know what happened, I kept those calves. During the summer, I didn't wean them until after I'd weaned my main cow herd. When we went to get them, I had 19 left. So I weaned them, and I put them in a corral separate, way away from the rest of the cows. And during that winter, every time there was a weather event or something that challenged those calves, I lost another one. I refused to treat them. I just thought they're going to die, so I did not treat a calf. By spring, I had 5 left. And I kept them, and I actually fed them. And probably something I didn't do is I did not retest them. 2 of those looked normal. And I'm thinking maybe 2 of them were normal. But 3 of them definitely had a look. But as Dan showed you, you can't tell by looking at them. They could have it and look normal. We did boost our cows again with the modified live. We had very little sickness that fall. 2005, we retested. We did it again. No PIs. We didn't have a 1. We did vaccinate our yearling heifers, and I think, maybe I didn't, it was on the screen, but the first year I did not vaccinate those yearling heifers. That was a mistake. We lucked out. We didn't have it. Apparently none of them had it. That, basically, my herd was the start of the Montana BVD biosecurity project. Clint Peck was at the ranch and wondered what in the heck those five yearlings at that time were doing in the garden. And I said, well, they're an experiment. So, anyway, that started the Montana BVD project. Spring of 2006, I participated in that program. Again, no positives out of that 1,300 to 1,400 cows. In January of last year, we actually purchased some yearling heifers, which we hadn't purchased any cattle for several years. We tested those yearling heifers. When they came to the ranch, they were negative. We also purchased a couple loads of bred heifers, and we did not test those heifers. We waited and tested their calves. And again, we lucked out. There were no positives in them. We did not do a whole herd test because we have deemed that we, through our biosecurity, we think that we're BVD free. Now, I think that I will occasionally test those cows again. And I think probably I will be more inclined to test the younger cows than I will the older cows. It begins at the ranch. I know that. I don't know where I got it, but I know it started at the ranch. Or it started on somebody else's ranch that where my cows were. PI calves, as you've been told, they're only created during gestation. So it's that critical time, as Dan has already told you. We need to be aware as ranchers that there is a critical time, and we need to be aware where our cows are. And if once they get it, they're always going to have it. And you need to get rid of them. Those two, that cow and calf, are both PI positive. Now, that isn't off of my ranch, but that is off of the Montana project. Some keys that we learned on our ranch: vaccinate. We had not been vaccinated. Now, I know, and Dan's alluded to it, that isn't going to solve all your problems, but it's going to help you. So, vaccinate. Proper nutrition is important because if your cattle are not in good nutrition, they're in poor condition, the vaccine is not as effective. Screen them. Test those calves. And in order to do that, you've got to have some kind of ID. And I think as in this world that we're in today, that's becoming even more important. Whole herd test. If you suspect you have a problem, I'm not going to stand up here and tell everybody here I think you need to go test. But if you see some of those things that have been mentioned in my talk or Dan's talk, abortions, sick calves that don't treat, calves that look a little different, I would recommend that you test those calves. You do a whole herd test to find out. The only way you're going to know is to test. Open replacement heifers, I think it's probably important. Anything that's going into your herd, make dang sure they're clean. Bulls. I mean, I would recommend you only buy bulls from producers that test them. I mean, you can test them at home, but I think it's more important that you know that they're coming from a herd that's clean. You don't need to screen your cows unless they have a positive calf. Again, as I said, open replacement heifers need to be tested. Purchase cattle, as we went through, we did it. In fact, it's a little, I'll just tell you a story on those purchased red heifers. I was positive. I would have bet anybody $100 that I had a PI calf by looking at it. In fact, I'd almost made myself sick thinking that I'd brought persistently infected calf back on my ranch. It wasn't. But it looked, it showed every part that there was. To tell you just a little bit about the Montana Project. And I think there's probably projects out there besides Montana's, but I'm aware of Montana's. And we would be more than happy in Montana to help anybody that wanted some help. I would be willing to talk, and I know Clint would too. We did 470 herds. 42 had a PI. 150,000 head have been screened. Only 139 PIs, and actually the majority of them were in a few herds. If you had it, you probably had multiple cases of it. But as you can see, it's mostly calves, but there was some yearling heifers. There were two cows. There was even a purebred yearling bull. That's a picture of some PI calves. They look fairly normal. I had neighbors that told me I was crazy the day that I weaned back in 2003, I guess it was, when I had those 19 calves. The day I weaned them, they looked as normal could be. I could have hauled them to the auction market. I know I could have. And nobody but me would have been the wiser. I just couldn't do it. I could not. We took that year, when you think of what calves were worth, we took a $25,000 hit because of PI. So you have, and if you think of the year before, I probably took maybe close to that too. And that's not including the abortions, and I don't know what happened. So it's imperative that U.S. ranchers know whether or not you have it in your herd. Again, as I said, I don't necessarily, and I don't think the project recommends that you do whole herd screening, but I think they do if you think you got a problem. Vaccinate, screen all new entries, re-screen if you think you have a breach, and maybe there's some market for PI calves, but my history is I would not keep them around. They would be gone from the ranch as soon as I knew I had a problem. And I think we're going to take some questions as we ride off into the sunset. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom. I'd like to invite Dave, Dan, and Tom to come up front here. The microphones are tied hard and fast here, so if you don't mind, if you have a question, just please come up to the mic one at a time, and these gentlemen will be happy to answer all your questions. We have about 20 minutes or so before lunch, so we have plenty of time to sit here and have a conversation with these guys and learn more about biosecurity. Could everyone use the microphones and just walk up here and ask your question, please?
Is it working? Yep. I'm a pedigree breeder from the UK, where we also have lots of problems with BVD. In fact, they show about 70% of herds in the UK are infected with BVD now, so it's getting very widespread. I've got two questions. Both relate to my own experience. And both are to do with vaccination. We went through a similar process to the one you went through, found that we had got some BVD in our herd, and we vaccinated the whole herd, all the cows, everything, the young stock, the whole herd. And our veterinarians have told us that we should repeat vaccinating the cows for a prolonged period because of the possibility of PIs being in the older group and those recreating BVD in the young stock thereafter, so that we should carry on vaccinating. First question is, do you believe in that? The second question is, we sell pedigree breeding bulls, and we have had, now that we are, when we test animals, we're virtually, we're showing we're free of BVD again now, but we're sending out bulls that are negative, and they're going out, because of this 70% of herds in the UK being infected, they're going out into positive herds, and we're getting complaints back from people saying, you sent me a BVD positive bull, and so should we vaccinate all the young bulls before they go out, in which case people won't necessarily be able to tell whether they've got BVD or not when they arrive.
A couple of great questions there. As I address those, I will give you, again, my professional opinion on what you described. First question is, should I repeatedly vaccinate cows? At this point in time, I have to recommend that you do repeatedly vaccinate cows because we don't know duration of immunity. We commonly recommend revaccination of cows annually. But I will stress to you that revaccination is clearly less important than the initial vaccination with modified live. So if you're prioritizing things on the farm, it's much more important to vaccinate those young heifers with modified live the first time than it is to revaccinate. But because we don't have good duration of immunity at this point, because of the lack of that data, we do need to recommend annual revaccination. Your second question relates to an important concept, and that is, I've tested my animals. I know that they're free of BVD. I haven't vaccinated those bulls that I might be sending out to other farms because I want them to maintain that antibody status of having no antibodies, which proves they've never been exposed to BVD. Unfortunately, in an environment like we are in the United States and what you describe in the United Kingdom, I would have to recommend that we vaccinate those animals after testing. They can never become persistently infected, but if we don't vaccinate them, then they are susceptible to that acute and transient disease, which may be severe if we don't vaccinate them prior to sending them out to other farms. So I would recommend vaccination of those bulls prior to sending them to other farms. Dave may have some comments that he would add to that.
I'll add a few things to that. One is this idea about why we vaccinate. So one reason to vaccinate might be to help reduce the probability of generating a PI calf. All right, and we've already said that's not 100%, but it could help minimize that. The second reason is to prevent the losses that go along with the transient infections, because when we have abortions, we have these health risks. And Tom did a good job of describing those vague things that happen in herds where BVD is present. So you could, in theory, say, all right, we've eliminated BVD from our herd. We don't have this challenge of exposure. We don't need to vaccinate anymore. And in fact, a number of European countries have essentially taken that approach. We'll use BVD serology as a way of knowing whether a herd's exposed or not. Nobody's vaccinated, but we get titers to BVD. We can measure antibodies to BVD. That means it was because wild virus was circulating in that herd. We don't take that approach in the United States because there is the risk of that reintroduction. And so we still want to maintain some protection of the herd, even though we don't believe BVD virus is circulating currently. We know it's, at any time, just like Tom's experience, it could be introduced, and we want to have that cow herd protected with the vaccine so we don't have these dramatic losses from the transient infections. So it's a little bit of a difference in strategy, but of course here we would say, we'll deal with the challenge of diagnosing BVD in the herd in turn for having the herd protected with the vaccine.
The first question concerning the Sand Hills trial is, when so much of us in the West are determining our production on utilization of our forages, that was an intensive grazing system where they were moved, I think you said, every couple days. In that case, when you moved the ones that hadn't calved and you left the ones there, what feed did they have left? Or were they moved later again? That was my first question.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll clarify a little bit. I gave you a herd history from a herd that was intensively grazed. And then I talked a little bit about how we implement this Sand Hills calving system. So now you have to separate these these two things. The intensively, well, so let me talk about the general thing first. So in a more traditional ranch setting where you're turning cows out in, maybe you're calving earlier in the spring. We're talking about utilizing these various calving pastures for the, and I didn't tell you that after the calves are about 4 weeks of age, we say you can start bringing these groups back together again. For a lot of our ranches, at least in Nebraska, that's about the time you're going to be turning those cows out into grass in the summertime. Okay, so I described the system for a more traditional setting, not the intensive grazing system. The intensive grazing herd, who is also utilizing this system, all right, so they're moving their herd through all of these pastures, and what we've asked them to do now is start to make lots of little groups that are moving through all those pastures. It's a little more complicated, and we've compromised a little bit. We've tried to breed as tight as you can, so we use less groups than we say every 10 days. So we stretch out that time period a little bit more. And again, so as they're moving through, they keep breaking off into more and more groups. All of those groups that have to move through the pasture. So it's more complicated for intensive grazing herds to implement the system. Not so difficult, really, for the more traditional ranch systems that we work with.
And eventually, they're all together again.
Once the youngest calf is 4 weeks old, we say they're not at risk for scours anymore, and so you can start to put them back together again, if that helps with your handling cattle.
And then on the BVD, I still get confused between determining PI calves and vaccinating your herd. You determine you don't have any PI calves. Is it possible to still have a PI cow that's still in your herd without testing your whole herd, or is that, what do you do in that case?
Your question, as I understand it, is trying to separate out vaccination versus biosecurity and keeping the virus off the farm. And the situation there, if you test all of the calves on the farm and you test all of the animals that have not given birth to a calf on the farm, that would be your bulls and your replacement heifers. Mm-hmm. If you test all of the calves and all of the animals that have not given birth to a calf and you have no PI animals in that testing, then you do not have persistently infected animals on the farm. So here's the challenge. If I, as a professional, were to tell you, you know, you did a great job. You did a great job testing. You don't have BVD on your farm, so let's not vaccinate. And then that'd be easy to prove to all of your neighbors that you don't have BVD. The problem is, if you have a neighbor who does buy persistently infected animal, that strain of BVD can go through your herd and cause significant transient infections and disease and even death associated with that transient infection. I do believe in the principle that if we don't learn history, we're destined to repeat it. And back in 1995, 96, there were some very virulent strains of BVD that went through herds that weren't vaccinated and caused up to a 40% death loss of animals due to acute infection. So even if you do a good job testing and don't have BVD on your farm, I do encourage you to buy the insurance that you gain with vaccination to prevent further disease.
Okay, then when you are vaccinating, you spoke of the time period is before breeding. If that is not possible, if they're on the range and they're back and they're gathered and branded where there are no facilities, is it possible to have a vaccination program for BVD? Or at what time? And what would you use? A modified live?
I'm going to answer this question and I'm going to let Dave clarify my answer. So your question, as I understand it, is you effectively understand that the best time to vaccinate is before breeding, because we want to optimize their immunity so that we protect that fetus during the first 5 months of gestation. You understand that principle, but say, with the management practices on that on my farm, I just can't do that. So if I can't do that, when's the next best time to vaccinate? Is that your question?
Yes.
With the parameters set forth on that question, you end up having to say, okay, what can we do? What will work with management practices? And on some farms, they've seen that it works acceptably well to make sure that heifers are well vaccinated. That's the most critical point on the farm to point out to you. Make sure those heifers get at least one dose of modified live vaccine. I would even encourage you to do two doses of modified live vaccines on the heifers. If you do that, at this point in time, we now have at least two modified live vaccines that are approved for administration to pregnant cows. If they were given the exact same vaccine within a 12-month period of time, 12 months previously. So, and I'll be honest to you, you've already set up the parameters of the question. That's not the optimal way to do it as far as protection against BVD, but that might optimize production on your farm, so you therefore might administer vaccine to pregnant animals so that you can ensure protection, but you're not going to have the greatest immunity during the first 5 months of gestation. I apologize for the complexity of that answer. Dave, do you want to tell her anything I said was wrong? Go ahead.
No, I think you said it right. So the...
If you're calving in the spring, but you're not able to vaccinate your cattle, the first time you can vaccinate your cattle is October, when they're gathered. Or when maybe when you ship and wean or test. If they're calving in, say they're not calving till June, July, and August, they're not getting bred till from July on. If you vaccinate in October, you're going to miss maybe on the earliest ones a couple months of protection, but maybe on the majority you get within the 5 months.
Yeah, but you end up, so our best recommendations would be to vaccinate prior to that breeding season. You're saying that's not possible. So the next best time to do it is when you can get your cattle in to vaccinate them.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what, you know, Dan's essentially saying is that, all right, vaccinate then, but at least if there's any possibility of getting two pre-breeding vaccinations into the heifers.
Into the heifers. Then you can use the modified live.
Yeah, and then at least you're boosting the cow herd over. Not the best time of the year to do it, but at least you're getting some boosted protection. And so that's a second best vaccine program given what can be done.
Okay, thank you.
I think if you vaccinate those cows in the fall and they've never had a modified live, you're at high risk for some abortions in them. That would be my understanding, the way I understand it.
Yeah, so we skirted that issue, and we probably shouldn't have. You know, it's very important that you follow the label directions for the vaccine. There are some vaccines that have a label now that say, so we're talking about modified live virus vaccines. Modified live virus vaccines can cause abortions in pregnant cows. You're talking about giving a vaccine to pregnant cows. And the only way we get around using modified live vaccines that way is if there has been a dose given in the previous 12 months. So it can happen, but you got to be real careful about how that's happened. There are also killed virus vaccines that are very safe and useful for giving pregnant cows when you can't meet those criteria for the modified live vaccines.
Current thought is killed vaccines, which are more safe, will provide less protection than modified lives.
when you've talked about whole herd test or trying to make sure there's no PIs in your herd, you've emphasized test every calf, the open heifers, and the bulls. I guess no one has really mentioned that cow that had a dead calf that you didn't ship. Was that just an oversight? Or I guess I would worry about those, even though they're mature and they're probably not PIs, they still could be that source of problem.
And you said it very well. The way I like to say that, test every calf on the farm and then test every cow that did not give birth to a calf that you tested. So we got to test those calves that had a dead calf. We've got to test those cows that didn't have any calves at all. We've got to test every calf, and then we have to test every animal on the farm that did not give birth to a calf that was tested.
I'll say the same thing Dan said, but just a different way. So when I'm explaining it to producers, I say, I want information on every animal on the ranch. However, I'm able to get information on cows that, if we test the calf, I'm able to get information about the cow from that. But if that cow lost her calf, didn't have a calf for whatever reason, then we've got to go to the cow to get that information. Otherwise, we got the information from the calf. And of course, if that calf was positive, we still have to go back to the cow.
I really don't have a question. I live in southeast Wyoming there, and we've run a closed herd since the 1950s. My eldest son took his prize heifer to the fair about 25 years ago and brought it home from there on a water source. And we've been through the kill virus vaccine, which is kind of more or less ineffective, and we finally got into the live virus. But the only real problem we have now is on summer 2-year-old heifers. We'll have a full-term dead calf, maybe about 5 or 6%, and we do go through a live virus vaccination.
Let me make sure I understand your comment there. You are administering that live virus vaccine to pregnant heifers, is what you're saying. Is that correct?
No.
Before they're pregnant.
So, from your story, so you're still saying that you still got it, and so that's the message that I think is very well worth repeating. If your total control program for BVD virus is solely vaccination, you can maintain the virus in your herd. And we've looked at ranches where we can show that the breeding pastures where there were PIs present, even in the face of vaccination, we still generated PIs the next year. So when we're thinking about BVD control, it's not just solely about testing. It's not just solely about vaccination. It's not just solely about movement of cattle. It's all of those things, and you've got to have all of those things as part of your plan, or you're letting something leak.
Yes, you mentioned about rental calving tubs and alleys and things like that, and dehorners and tagging pliers and such. What would be the timeline on that virus living on such instruments?
Fortunately, they live well in the environment to give you an adequate time range for that virus to die. I normally like to say 5 weeks. So 4 to 5 weeks. And you can decrease that to 3 weeks. In the southeast, where we tend to be pretty warm and hot, 3 weeks normally is plenty of time for the virus to die. It does not live for long periods of time without infecting an animal. So the outside longest window that you can say I have 100% confidence the virus will die on that type of equipment would be a 5-week period of time. It's going to be gone.
I'm Mike Amos. I work for Pfizer Animal Health, and I wanted to clarify some things with regards to the use of modified lives in pregnant cows and give you our current recommendation. And the one thing we want to emphasize, if you're going to use a modified live in a pregnant cow, you have to give the pre-breeding shot. If you don't, you're going to have problems. So our current recommendation, and it's on all of our advertising, is that we get two doses of that modified live with the second dose coming pre-breeding. And then you shouldn't have any problems. We have millions of doses that have been administered to pregnant cows and verifies its safety. So we want to reemphasize that. Some people, when we first got the pregnant cow claimed for BovaShield Gold, considered pre-breeding to be that time when she at weaning time. Well, that is pre-breeding, but it's the 30 to 60 days prior to breeding, which we would typically call pre-breeding. The second point of clarification is there is actually only one vaccine that is approved for use within 12 months thereafter. There are two vaccines that are approved for modified lives that are approved for use in pregnant cows, but only one that can be used within 12 months thereafter because it's been demonstrated to have the safety and et cetera. I've been given within 12 months thereafter. So that's another point of clarity. I do have a question with regards to Dr. Gibbons. If you could give us an update on the current thinking on persistent testicular infection and whether that potentially has a role and what someone purchasing bulls, whether they should be doing any different testing if they've got any questions in that regard.
Great question. Let me ask one clarifying question on one thing to make sure I understand it. That you talked about that 12-month period, and I want to make sure that I'm clear on that. There's only one vaccine, and that's the BovaShield product, that can be given. Explain that 12-month period, because I'm just not sure I'm clear on that.
We have it specifically on the label. If the initial vaccines have been given pre-breeding, you can administer it to a pregnant cow. Typically the time when people want to do it is at preg check time in that October time frame. As long as you've given that pre-breeding shot within 12 months of wanting to give it at preg check time, you're okay. It's the only vaccine that has that specific labeling on it. The other product that's approved for use in pregnant cows is only approved for use pre-breeding, period. What a lot of people will do is evolve. They'll use it pre-breeding in their heifers because they can do that. And then with time, you know, this is going to take quite a time. And you really have to be very vigilant about identification. But if you've got your cow, your heifers marked by the year that they were born or whatever, it can be managed. But the other alternative is to use a product like Cattlemaster Gold, which is has a killed BVD, which is approved for use in pregnant cows regardless. There's no requirement. And that does have a persistent infection point. If you want to use a modified live in your cows, you have to give the first shot pre-breeding. Within 12 months, then you can go. But so if you kind of have to bite the bullet, and if you want to do it in your cows, you have to give a pre-breeding shot, either as a heifer or as a cow at some point. Yeah, the question was, could you use a killed vaccine at preg check time 1 year and then switch to a modified live at preg check time the next year? The answer to that question is no. Well, you could, but you wouldn't be very happy with the results. We are investigating whether you could use a product like Cattle Master Gold, which is a killed BVD product that does have a pregnant cow, a persistent infection claim, use that to qualify to go on the modified live program. But until we have that information, we couldn't make that recommendation. It would be irresponsible.
Mike, thanks for fielding some of those vaccine questions. I'm glad you're there to answer some of those, because those can get pretty technically oriented, and I think it's worth us saying, make sure you follow label directions.
Yeah, and if you have any questions, contact your local veterinarian or your local Pfizer rep or one of our veterinary operations people. They can walk you through. We've got a lot of experience in transitioning your herd to a pregnant, a modified live pregnant cow program.
I did want to address your question concerning the testicular infections. And Mike brings up a topic that we've looked at quite a bit, and it's a situation where if a young bull is exposed to a non-cytopathic strain of BVD as his initial exposure to virus, that virus will cause a testicular infection that can last for years. The animal's not persistently infected throughout its body, but it just has the virus in its testicular tissue, and it will shed some of that virus in the semen. Therefore, we do have some very definite recommendations we can make. One, make sure that the first exposure of that bull is not to a non-cytopathic strain. It's very clear, based on research that's been published here in the U.S., bulls should not be vaccinated for the first time with a modified live vaccine containing a non-cytopathic strain. We do have two of those vaccines in the United States. Those should not be used as the first vaccine for a group of young bulls. Modified lives that contain cytopathic strains, and the work has been done with Bovishield Gold to demonstrate that that product is safe and effective in preventing testicular infections. If bulls are exposed to a non-cytopathic strain for the very first time, that virus lives in the testicular tissue, it can be shed in the semen. Looking only at very limited numbers, we have not been able to show transmission. We can demonstrate that that virus is alive in the testicular tissue. We can demonstrate that the virus is live in the semen. We can grow it out of the semen. But we've only been able to obtain funding to breed about 10 heifers with that semen, and none of those 10 seroconverted or produced persistently infected calves. If you're a basketball fan or a football fan, if somebody misses 10 free throws or 10 field goals, does that mean they're never going to hit one? It certainly doesn't. If you run the statistics, that just means it's going to be transmitted less than 25% of the time. So there is some concern there on bulls. We want to make sure bulls are exposed to a cytopathic strain the first time they're exposed or immunized, not to a non-cytopathic vaccine, which can cause testicular infection, or to an exposure to a PI animal, or to some other type of exposure to non-cytopathic BVD. So it's a good question, situation where we need to be concerned about that. As far as testing bulls that you might purchase right now, we're not at the point that we feel like we can recommend testing of those bulls. The ideal test to run is a PCR test. That can be done in air lab and lots of other labs. Texas A&M has a lab that can do that for you. But until we show transmission, we don't want to waste producers' focus by focusing on that until we show that it can be transmitted, which I hope that if it can be transmitted, we'll show that within the next year.
You feel confident that the sellers give you some vaccination?
That's correct. If the seller could give me vaccination history that they were vaccinated with a modified live that contained a cytopathic strain, meaning I've got two vaccines out there that if I had an individual tell me that's what they were vaccinating their bulls with, I would be willing to say, don't buy those bulls until you test them, because I know that those two vaccines that contain modified live non-cytopathic strains can actually cause the problem.
I'd like to thank Dave, Dan, and Tom for talking to us today. We are out of time.
And there will be lunch in the ballrooms. They are the C rooms.
This has been a production of Angus Productions Incorporated, the industry's information leader.